Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show here on 102.7 FM Co-op Radio, CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, February the 18th, 2011. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I am joined here today by my co-host, Alyssa Ray. Hello, Alyssa.
Hi, Allison.
And our other co-host, Carissa, is unfortunately not able to be with us here today. On today's show, we have two interviews for you. First up, we have one of my favorite recurring guests, Nathan Runkle, on the show. Nathan is the executive director for the very active and progressive nonprofit animal advocacy organization, Mercy for Animals, which is based in the United States. Nathan is here today to speak to us about a new short documentary film that MFA has just released to the public in recent weeks called Farm to Fridge, narrated by actor James Cromwell. And as you may or may not know, James Cromwell, who played the farmer in the Babe movies, actually went vegetarian many years ago while filming Babe and due to filming Babe, and still remains an ardent advocate for the animals today. I knew that this film was going to be tough to watch as it's quite graphic, but I also knew that it was important to watch. And there's been a lot of buzz about it in the animal rights world lately, so I know that MFA does such a top-notch multimedia outreach work. So I did watch it, and I have to say that it's now probably the best short film out there on the subject of exactly how your food gets from the animal farm to your fridge. And Alyssa, I know you saw it. You didn't exactly listen to it, but you saw it. What did you think? Tough stuff, huh?
Well, yeah, it gave me that disgusting feeling in my tummy, but in a way, I really enjoy being a witness. Like, I know it's really hard, but when my heart opens to the pain and suffering of others, I just feel like there's room to let love in, and I just kind of felt like, okay, this is another reminder of why I need to do what I do and why I'm an activist.
It's kind of a reaffirmation. I do look forward to this interview coming up shortly after our events listings. For our feature interview today, we will be speaking with Jason Hirabal, who is an educator, historian, and author of the new book called Fear of the Animal Planet, The Hidden History of Animal Resistance. When I first read about this book, I was understandably intrigued. It's an interesting title, right? The book seems to be the only one of its kind that dwells deeply into what really is the hidden history of resistance of animals in captivity. That is, animals held in captivity by humans in circuses, zoos, aquariums, and research laboratories. Jason shares with his readers a nearly endless plethora of story after story of many different instances of where animals have used their instinctive skills and desire for survival and freedom to escape from their captors, and in many cases to even shamelessly kill their captors. If you didn't think that this kind of thing is a common occurrence, well, think again, and you'll be surprised by the kinds of stories that Jason has to share with us. If you're particularly intrigued by this subject, we do have an extra free copy of Jason Hirabal's new book to give away to a lucky listener. That's right, we are doing another Animal Voices contest giveaway for a copy of Fear of the Animal Planet, The Hidden History of Animal Resistance. All you have to do to enter is to go on to our Facebook page, which is called Animal Voices Vancouver, click on the Discussions tab at the top, and submit your entry there. Or if you're not on Facebook, simply send us an email with contest entry as the subject title at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. To be eligible to enter, you must need not to have won anything from us in the last year, and you must be able to pick up your prize from our radio station in downtown Vancouver. Entries are due next Friday, February the 25th, and we will draw for the winner on the show next Friday, so good luck. Before we move on to the rest of the show, I wanted to briefly mention a new website that I found out about this week that could be a useful tool for those who are interested in planning a cruelty-free vegan wedding. There's actually a website now to help you plan your vegan wedding, and you can find it at www.rosepetalsveganweddings.com, and we have that link posted on our website too if you want to find it there. Our website is animalvoices.org. So as you may be aware, Veg News Magazine does a yearly feature, which is actually their most popular magazine of the year, I think, where they profile a bunch of couples who have planned and carried out vegan weddings in the previous year. And I always find these stories to be really inspiring and interesting to read, to see all the different ways in which all of these couples have prepared their weddings to share the common theme of being cruelty-free. And the best part for me, at least, is always reading about the food that was served, because if you're vegan and you're going to get married, what better way to do some outreach than to show off to your guests how wonderful and delicious vegan food can be. This website, Rose Petal Vegan Weddings, not only shares stories of couples' vegan nuptials to give you ideas, but also posts tips and resources for planning your own vegan wedding. Just from a quick perusal, I found a recipe for vegan Mexican wedding cookies, an article on getting your makeup done on your wedding day, and suggestions for animal-friendly accessories to wear. Although it has just started, I think this website has a lot of potential, so I wanted to share it with our listeners and invite you to check it out. I think it's just lovely that there's one place like this online that will hopefully grow and become known as a main resource to go to when planning a vegan wedding. Now, Alyssa, you were telling me, you looked at the website yourself. What did you think of it?
I did. Well, at first I wasn't sure what to think. I wondered if it was a wedding planner, but it's mostly just like a resource house for people who are getting married, and it offers links to all kinds of vegan help, from music and photographers to flowers and cosmetics, like on top of food. So I thought that was really interesting, and I'd definitely like to see more Canada in there. So if you
totally,
if our listeners know of anyone that can help with weddings who offer any kind of service, I highly recommend emailing the website.
Yeah, people are encouraged to submit information. And you were telling me, too, that you're going to a vegan wedding?
I am. Actually, I brought a friend of mine to see Earthlings recently, and she and her boyfriend went vegan after, and nice. They're getting married this summer. So I'm really excited to see what they'll do. I haven't quite talked about their plans. Oh, it's not this summer. It's a year from now. But I'll definitely pass on this website, and I really look forward to experiencing a vegan wedding, my first.
I think that'll be a lot of fun. And you said before, too, that you went to a wedding that had a lot of vegan options and all vegan desserts.
It's nice
when you can go to a wedding and eat all the desserts.
It was such a surprise. I had no idea. I felt like it was just for me, but I remember there was other vegans in the room.
Well, that was really considerate of the hosts, you know, to do that for you.
Yeah, completely, right?
Yeah, really awesome. So we do have our upcoming events now, Alyssa.
Yes, we do. So happening this weekend, actually just started at noon, is the 19th Annual Wellness Show this weekend at the Vancouver Convention Center. If you're taking notes, it's in the West Building, Exhibit Hall C. So it's today, noon till 8, Saturday, 10 till 7, and Sunday, 10 until 6. I'm mentioning it because there's a couple of our friends there. The Vancouver Humane Society will be there talking about cage-free eggs and other such compassionate choices for shopping. And Earth Save will also be there. Carissa, our co-host, will be there most of the weekend, and I'll be there this evening. So come by, say hi, learn a little bit about healthy living. I hear this is an amazing show along the lines of Taste of Health, but a lot more, full body healing and spiritual healing and things like that. It should be good. And it's $12.50 for general admission, $10 for seniors and students, $5 for children, and free for 5 years and under. There's a $2 off coupon at Choices Markets. Next Wednesday is Liberation BC's monthly volunteer night. It's at the Mount Pleasant Community Center at from 6 till 9, Wednesday, February 23rd. And
I'm going to the next one. Did you mention that we're planning the next animal advocacy camp?
Yeah, definitely. That will be very exciting. Mm. So, and it'll be bigger than last year. We need a lot of help to make it happen.
Mm. We had almost 100 people attend last year. It was just an awesome
event.
Excellent.
And hopefully this year will be 300 or something. So we need a lot of help planning, and it's going to be an open space concept, and that brings activists together to share and converse in a non-hierarchical setting. Attendees are active contributors to the event, and they're ultimately responsible for what they get out of it. And it's going to be a great big event that kicks off smaller and more focused dialogue events taking place throughout the year. So if you want to get involved with that, make sure to contact Liberation BC or just show up at the volunteer night next Wednesday. Also next Wednesday is the Vancouver Meatless Meetup has organized a gourmet dinner at the Helm. There's not many places where vegans can go to experience a fancy meal in Vancouver, And so the organizer has created this very special event for us. It promises to be an adventure in gustatory delights. Dinners will be served family style on platters, and we'll enjoy around 12 different dishes throughout the evening, including almond stuffed dates and spiced popcorn, heirloom tomato consomme, golden beet ravioli, and hazelnut vinaigrette.
That sounds very yummy.
Anytime I hear the word ravioli, that's I go
vegan
crazy.
Vegan ravioli. Oh, you can't best. You can't even buy it here in Vancouver.
They offer it at Carmivore. It's a new item I just saw. I'm very excited.
Okay.
Also, wild mushroom cabbage rolls with smoked onion puree and walnuts. Oh, I could go on. Sounds so good. Many things on the full menu list I've never even heard of, including soca, za'atar, and feef bread. I have no idea, but I know that this night promises to be one to remember. The Helm is an elegant and vivacious supper club sort of atmosphere in downtown Vancouver, and the meetup coordinator worked hard with the chef to provide a fancy vegan meal for diners that promises to leave everyone satisfied. Yes, the dinner is a bit pricey at $43, including tax and tip, but it looks to me like it'll be really worth it. Reservations are required, and you can do that by Googling Vancouver Meatless Meetup. If you don't have 40 bones to spare and you still want to get out and meet other compassionate folk, well, the following week on March 4th, there is a cafe mix and mingle at Memento Coffee House. This is also organized by the Meatless Meetup group in Vancouver. There'll be a fun house party type of atmosphere as we take over the entire coffee house. And basically, you pay $4.50 and you get an amazing soy chai latte. With that, it saves you 50 cents if you buy in advance. Reservations are needed. And then basically you can just buy your own vegan goodies or other drinks at your discretion. So it's a cheap one. And apparently, yeah, they have lots of vegan goodies to share. So that'll be fun. And yeah, I just wanted to actually give a little heads up. It's not for another month or so, but if you have kids and you're an animal lover and you want, you know, a compassionate event for your kids, the SPCA is holding a youth workshop March 21st and 22nd. It's called What's the Buzz? Meow, Squeak, Woof. And there's information on SPCA's website. It's just looks like a fun event for kids to learn about animal language and animal care. I'm not exactly sure the details, but it definitely sounds like fun. And if you have an animal or vegetarian-related event coming up that you'd like to have announced on the show, please don't hesitate to email us the details at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com or post it on our Facebook page, which is called Animal Voices Vancouver.
You are listening to 102.7 FM CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. This is the Animal Voices Radio Show. For our first interview today, we have Nathan Runkle, who is the Executive Director for the U.S. National Nonprofit Animal Advocacy Organization, Mercy for Animals. Nathan is here to speak to us about a riveting new short documentary film that MFA has just released to the public in recent weeks called Farm to Fridge, narrated by BAFE actor James Cromwell. After watching it myself, I found it to be such a compelling and important film to be imparted unto the world that I asked Nathan if he would come onto the show to speak with us about it. Hello, Nathan, and welcome to the Animal Voices Show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming back. So please tell us, what was the impetus behind Mercy for Animals deciding to create this film? And can you summarize for us what it is all about?
Sure. Well, I think that video footage of animals suffering on factory farms and in hatcheries and slaughter plants is really the most powerful tool that the animal protection movement has at raising awareness and opening the hearts and minds of consumers to the plight that these billions of animals are subjected to. It was video footage that got me involved in animal rights and so many other activists. So we wanted to compile a film, a short film, that would go through the lives and deaths of cows, pigs, chickens, turkeys, and fish and graphically illustrate the cruelty that they endure before they reach the dinner table. And Farm to Fridge is sort of a silver bullet. It covers all of these issues in a no-holds-bar format, and it's graphic and it's eye-opening, but we feel like it's a film that needs to be seen.
And with the power of having the internet, you know, you don't have to rely on television like many years ago. You're able to get it out there, right? So it's wonderful that we have that technology these days that we didn't have perhaps even 10 years ago. So it really is getting out there. I'm wondering who is your specific targeted audience that this film is for?
Well, really, the audience for this film is everyone, because everyone eats and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table on whether we want to support the egregious cruelty that farmed animals are subjected to, or whether we want to live our values of kindness and compassion and mercy by adopting a vegetarian or vegan diet. So it's really targeted towards a broad audience, but more specifically college students, young individuals that are really thirsty for the truth and want to know exactly how these animals are treated, because so often we're fed a sugar-coated view of the treatment that farm animals endure through misleading advertisements and TV commercials by the meat, dairy, and egg industry and PR representatives that tell us that these animals live happy and content lives until they have one bad day and they're killed at the slaughterhouse. But Farm to Fridge really is a wake-up call, and it shows how animals are intensively confined and mutilated without painkillers, separated from their families, how they have their throats slit while they're fully conscious. So we hope that everyone far and wide will not only watch the film, but will also share it with others.
I like how you mentioned how some people are sort of disillusioned to think that they only have that one bad day at the slaughterhouse, like Michael Pollan recently said on the Oprah show, which really irked me. And you're right. It's showing that is actually not true. So thank you for that. How does this film differ from PETA's popular short film, Meet Your Meat, which is similar in its theme and message?
Yeah, well, Meet Your Meat is a great film, and I think that it was definitely a wake-up call for many activists and a catalyst for many people going vegetarian and vegan. And we hope that Farm to Fridge sort of builds off of that. This film includes sea life, which is not covered in Meet Your Meat, and it's also just a much more updated film. It has footage from a lot more investigations that have occurred just in the past 3 years even, and it documents a lot of typical practices that were not documented or covered in Meet Your Meat. So we think that it is a great new tool for the animal advocacy movement, and we hope that people will use it and share it with others.
Yeah, this film covers a spectrum of animal factory farming issues. I was writing them down as I was watching it. There's pigs to eggs to chickens to cows. And as you mentioned, it even has a section on seafood in it, which is not a usual inclusion when you're seeing a film that is presenting on factory farming. Why was it decided to cover the issue of seafood here and how that gets to one's fridge? And can you tell us about some of the issues that it covers about aquatic animals in this film?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, fish and other sea life are killed at an alarming rate. Even more sea life is killed for human consumption than poultry. And we know that in the United States and elsewhere, billions of birds are killed for food. Well, it's the same with fish, but these animals are really neglected, not only by society at large, but also, for the most part, by the animal protection community. And these are animals that experience pain and suffering in much the same way as birds and mammals do. It may be more difficult for people to sympathize and relate to the suffering of these animals because they look so different from us, and people may not consider them to be cute or cuddly, but the reality is that they certainly have needs and interests and desires, and they deserve every bit as much protection from abuse as land animals do. So we wanted to make sure that their suffering and the horrific treatment that they're subjected to was covered in the film. There's no federal laws that protect sea life, and most state anti-cruelty statutes exempt them as well. So in many cases, they have even less protection than farmed animals, land animals, which, as we know, have very little protection already. So the film covers the way in which sea life, both wild-caught and farmed-raised, make it to the table, and it includes footage of animals being caught in huge trawler nets, which essentially clear-cut the ocean, capturing everything and everyone that's in its path, creating massive dead zones, ripping fish up from the depths of the ocean, leading to ruptured swim bladders and their eyes popping out of their heads, just horribly mm-hmm. painful decompression, and animals that are literally hacked apart on these boats, which are like floating slaughterhouses. It also includes footage from a recent investigation that we did at a slaughter plant in the U.S. that revealed animals being skinned and dismembered and having their heads ripped off while they're still alive and conscious. Just really egregious abuse that these fish are subjected to.
So this is a very graphic film with its images, and as you have mentioned, there's quite a lot of video images from your own undercover video investigations, which is a large part of what your organization does to expose factory farming and cruelty to the public. Can you tell us about other types of graphic imagery on the treatment to animals that people can expect to see in Farm to Fridge? And why do you think it's important that people are exposed to these vivid images?
Well, I think it's important that consumers be well-informed. And as I said before, we're really spoon-fed such misinformation from the meat, dairy, and egg industries. So this film is graphic, but it's honest, and it shows exactly what these animals are subjected to. So some of the images that people can expect to see in the film are mainly industry standards. These are completely legal, accepted, and practices that are even defended to the end by the agribusiness industry. So things like animals, everything from breeding fowls to egg-laying hens to baby calves, chained or locked inside of tiny crates, cages, and pens so small that the animals can't even turn around, they can't extend their own limbs, they can't even lie down comfortably. This is, unfortunately, the fate that billions of animals are subjected to worldwide. They don't have the same protection from abuse as dogs and cats. People can also expect to see baby piglets being castrated, having their tails cut off, cows being dehorned, having their horns burned out of their skulls, their tails ripped off. All of these horrible mutilations without a single drop of painkillers, including baby chicks having their beaks burned off or seared off with hot lasers. They can also see baby male chicks, which are considered useless to the egg industry because they won't mature to lay eggs and they're of a different breed than meat-type birds, being thrown into giant grinding machines or macerators while they're still alive. This is a common practice in the egg industry. Hundreds of millions of male chicks meet this fate every year. People can also see the cruelty in the dairy industry, where these cows are hooked up to automated milking machines day in and day out. They can see the cruel slaughter practices that happens both for chickens and turkeys, who have really no legal protection from abuse on a federal level at slaughter plants, and also abuse from workers. Workers slamming baby piglets headfirst into the ground in attempts to kill them, and sadistic abuse, which has been documented time and time again during these undercover investigations. Workers stabbing cows with pitchforks or beating pigs with iron crowbars, things that unfortunately are widespread and commonplace in these industries, where the animals are viewed as production units and commodities, not as sentient individuals that deserve our compassion and respect.
I think that would be a lot of information and images to take in for the average person, but as you're saying, it's important for people to know these things, and I do think it's our duty to know what is happening to the creatures on our earth. Now, the website or the video has been out for a couple of weeks now, I think. It's on its own website, meatvideo.com, as well as on YouTube. And the last time I checked this week, which was a couple days ago, it already had over 49,000 views on YouTube, and I know other people have been posting it too, and it's got thousands and thousands of views on those sites as well. What kind of feedback have you been getting from those being exposed to this information for perhaps the first time?
Yeah, the response has been incredible. We've heard from so many people directly that say that the film has just totally opened their eyes and changed their way of thinking about the food choices that they make. But we've also heard from longtime vegetarians and vegans who have posted it on their Facebook wall, and they've had brothers or sisters or longtime friends who just didn't get why they would be so concerned about this issue, who finally watched the film and they're now making the transition to a vegetarian diet and they're finally get it. So I think that there's no substitute for actually seeing what these animals go through. We can talk about it in theory and hypotheticals, but to actually witness with our own eyes these animals' plights is rather eye-opening for many people. And it is graphic, and a lot of people don't make it through the first few minutes of the film, but I think that that in and of itself should say so much to us. It should speak volumes to this mm-hmm. out-of-control food industry that is so cruel and violent to animals that most people don't even want to witness what's going on.
Yeah, that's true. And for people who have been impacted by the film, you encourage them to move towards exploring a vegan diet. What kinds of resources can you direct people to help them on their path towards compassionate eating?
Well, we have a website, chooseveg.com, and that is sort of a one-stop resource for anyone that's interested in making the transition to a plant-based diet. We have hundreds of vegan recipes. We have cooking videos. People can order a free copy of our vegetarian starter kit, which includes all sorts of resources and recipes as well. We also have undercover videos. We have recommended resources on that site as well. So chooseveg.com is really the best place that people can go. But we also partner with another organization to create vegguide.org. And vegguide.org is a worldwide mm-hmm. listing of vegetarian-friendly restaurants. There's over 10,000 establishments listed there, so it's a great resource as well.
I've used that site myself when traveling. It's been very useful. So thanks for putting
great.
That one out there. Yeah, thank you so much, Nathan, for coming on the show today to speak to us about Mercy for Animals' new short film documentary, Farm to Fridge. You can view this video yourself at meatvideo.com. Thanks so much again.
Thank you so much for having me.
Bye-bye.
Fruit Salad, Thursday nights at 7 p.m. on CFRO Co-op Radio 102.7 FM. Always fresh and unexpected for over 20 years with hosts Aiden Saint and Sky. Juicy, in-depth interviews with musicians, writers, performers, queer organizations, and families. Find out how fabulous and varied queer life really is. A show for all sexualities. Expect the unexpected. Fresh fruit every Thursday night at 7 p.m. on 102.7 FM. Catch a live stream at cooperadio.org or on cable in Greater Vancouver and across Canada on Star Choice Channel 845. Contact us at queerradiovancouver@gmail.com.
Hello, you're listening to the Animal Voices Show on Friday, February 18th, and this is 102.7 Co-op Radio in Vancouver, and this is some news. Came out recently that SeaWorld is likely to petition an administrative judge to close hearings into the death of senior trainer Don Branchot, who was killed by an orca last February at SeaWorld Orlando, according to a statement issued by the group The Orca Project. SeaWorld also reportedly wants all testimony and other evidence sealed from what is sure to be a heated and emotional hearing this April. This at issue is whether SeaWorld acted with negligence in the death of Branchot, who was mauled, dismembered, and drowned by the killer whale Tilikum, an animal that was already involved in the deaths of two other people. Last August, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, found SeaWorld willfully responsible and issued citations and fines totaling $75,000. Actually, our next interview, Jason will talk about talks about Tilikum the whale in his book, which is called Fear of the Animal Planet, The Hidden History of Animal Resistance, and that's coming up in just a couple minutes. In order to contest the suit, SeaWorld attorneys will have to clearly lay blame for Dawn's demise squarely on her own shoulders, which is a little bit disturbing, as she was a 16-year veteran and valued staff at SeaWorld. And they'll have to fend off scathing accusations by OSHA attorneys who will argue that SeaWorld continually put profit over personal safety when it came to killer whales. One can easily understand why SeaWorld might want to close these hearings. It's a multi-billion-dollar corporation who doesn't want to air its dirty laundry. But this is, of course, a public matter involving federal investigation conducted at a taxpayer expenses, and it involves serious worker safety issues and the treatment of captive marine mammals, which is also subject to federal regulations.
So you're saying that SeaWorld wants to put the trainer at fault, is that right?
Well, they would have to in order to, I mean, they're being charged with $75,000 and I don't think they want to pay and they don't want dirty laundry, so they don't want to be held at fault. So they have to place
blame. I'm not sure how they can do
blame.
That when the trainer was working for SeaWorld, right? She was a representative of them.
They would have to say that she was negligent. And that it wasn't their fault. But what the OSHA is saying, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, is saying that they knew of the dangers of working with these animals well in advance. These incidences have happened in the past at SeaWorld and at other aquariums.
No kidding.
And
they have to read Jason Hirable's book about that too.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's crazy that they would say something like that. And from what I know is there's so many accounts of what happened in that situation. It's like no one actually really knows. I'm sure someone knows, but from what the public knows, it's not clear.
But, and this is why the public needs to know what's actually happening, and this case should not be closed. You know, the public needs to know.
They're sweeping it under the carpet.
Exactly. And it's very likely that it will be a closed hearing. But you can get more information on what the public can do to demand open hearings by visiting the Orca Project website. We need to know more about this, and we need to hear what expert witnesses have to say. And maybe if people had more information about these types of events and could understand more about the, you know, terrible, terrible lives of these beautiful creatures, then we would see less of them in captivity. That would be great, but not great for SeaWorld. And in other whaling news, or whale news, I'm happy to report some good news for our cetacean friends in the Antarctic. It was reported a few days ago that the Japanese whale hunt had been halted since the 10th of February, but it wasn't clear whether the season had been called off, or if it was just a temporary suspension. News reports today are confirming that the whale hunt season in Japan has been called off 1 month early.
And that's amazing news.
It is amazing news, and this is the first time that Japan is citing activist pressure as the reason. And it's the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. They've been doing an excellent job of using their boats and manpower to stay close to the main slaughter ship, and have been using tactics like smoke bombs, bottles filled with rancid butter or red paint, and things like that to distract and slow the hunting crew.
They're never violent. They make sure that they never hurt people. And Captain Paul Watson, who's the head of that mission, is always saying, but we're not doing anything illegal. They're not doing anything illegal. It's the Japanese that are actually illegally whaling. There's a ban on whaling, and they're doing it.
Yeah, there has been a ban on whaling since 1986. That's commercial whaling. And Japan is stating that what they're doing is perfectly legal for scientific reasons. And the Institute for Cetacean Research, which is the Japanese whaling boat institute, I guess, they state that their objectives for these scientific missions are based around sustainability for when the commercial whaling does resume. So they're not really covering that up, but they're saying that they are.
Sustainability, because they have 5,000 pounds of unused whale meat in their freezers, which has also been another reason that has been cited as to why they were cutting the whaling season short. Apparently it was leaked to Greenpeace Japan that they were going to cut short anyways. But as I was saying to you earlier, Alyssa, their quota that they set for this year was 865 whales, and they only met one-fifth of that quota because of the Sea Shepherd blocking them and stopping them, creating obstacles. Is it really worth the risk, the money, the manpower? You know, going to the Arctic is very dangerous, knowing that there's Sea Shepherd boats after you and trying to make it difficult for you. Now, they only caught about 100 whales. Is that worth it when they already have 5,000 pounds of unused whale meat in their freezers? Because in actuality, from what I've read, Japan doesn't want to eat whale meat anymore.
That's good news. Yeah, it's there's, you know, not whatever, that commercial demand.
Yeah, whatever the reason is, whether it's no demand, or I think it might be a combination of both. Let's hope it is. You know, I think without the Sea Shepherd, they wouldn't have returned early.
Yeah, and thanks to all the new press with the awesome show Whale Wars, which is in its third season, and a lot of high-profile support. Sea Shepherd can definitely count this as a success.
So for our feature interview today, we have on the show with us Jason Hirabal, who is a historian and educator and has just recently had a book published called Fear of the Animal Planet, The Hidden History of Animal Resistance. Jason is here today to speak to us about this book. Hello, Jason, and welcome to the Animal Voices show.
How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. I hope you are as well, and I'm very excited to talk to you about this subject. I have read the book, and I have to say that I've never known of such a book to be written on the subject before. That is on the history of the resistance of animals in captivity. It's a topic that I'm glad someone has taken the time to do an obvious huge amount of research on to compile into this volume. Can you first tell us why you wrote the book and also give us a short summary of its contents, please?
Sure. I started it in, I started really the research for it in 1998. I was taking I just started my doctorate, and I was taking just a seminar, and I had no real interest in animals at the time. I was completely indifferent. I was, in fact, fairly cynical, and somewhat conservative of my views towards other creatures. And I had to pick some sort of topic, so I said Toledo Zoo, because I was in Toledo, Ohio, and the zoo's fairly famous. And there's materials to get. But as I was doing the research, I kept on seeing more and more. I kept on seeing this, like escapes and attacks and the zoos having internal conversations about this and stuff in the newspapers. And it kept on more and more, and the evidence kept on piling up. And that really, it completely changed my thinking and changed the direction of my life at the time. And I would pick it up again in 96. For an essay after Kasatka attacked a trainer at SeaWorld. And then about a year after that, I started really writing the book itself.
And the book tells a lot of stories about captive performing animals, such as in circuses, repeatedly escaping from their enclosures. The first chapter is about tigers and is called A Message from Tatiana. Can you tell us about the story of Tatiana the tiger?
Sure. She was born in the Denver Zoo, and then at a young age transferred to San Francisco, which is normal. Animals exchange hands a lot. And they're often taken fairly young from their mothers. And then in 2006, she made the news because she attacked a trainer and bit the trainer's arm. And then in December of 2007, she made the big news, the international news, when she escaped from her enclosure, jumping over a moat and climbing a wall, killing one person who was teasing her, and going after the other two and severely injuring them. And then she would be in the news again this past Sunday in the San Francisco Chronicle as the USDA, who oversees the zoos, released its report, and they said that Tatiana did this action on purpose, with intent, with purpose. And they inferred heavily that it was done with revenge against these three individuals.
So some people might say that such a claim is met with an accusation of anthropomorphism, that is, ascribing human emotions and intellect and intent to animals. What is your response to this accusation?
Well, the USDA is a very conservative, if not reactionary.
I know. I'm surprised.
So for them to start saying that, and then I don't know if you heard about Eddie, the female elephant from the Knoxville Zoo who last month killed a trainer.
No, I didn't actually.
Yes, killed a trainer, and the zoo, of course, said it was accidental. And then the report that came out this week from the Tennessee Wildlife Service or something, again, another really conservative organization, said that she did it intentionally, and the zoo was kind of having a hissy fit about this. So we have two organizations, both conservative, if not reactionary, attributing an intent and purpose to these actions. As far as anthropomorphism, it's really an ingrained thing in people. I did this one-hour radio show call-in yesterday in San Francisco together with someone from the Oakland Zoo, some curator. And it's funny. I was waiting for her to say the magic word because she was saying all animals, they have unique intelligence and, you know, unique abilities, but you can't really compare them to humans. And then she said the magic word, which is the relationship in zoos is all about control.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's it. That's the whole crux right there. This is a power dynamic, and with the key on dynamic, because it's two-sided. You know, we tend to focus just our interest and vision on one side, the zoos. And that's the, you know, the focus that she was taking, and some of the focus that a lot of the people calling in were taking. And that has to do a lot with anthropomorphism, you know, as an ideology, right?
Yeah.
But again, this is two-sided, right? This is dominance and resistance. And so the whole part of the book is to look at that other side of the relationship that most people tend not to do.
And as the title says, this is a hidden history. I don't think anyone who hasn't read this book, except for, you know, I don't think people are aware that this has happened multiple times. I was fascinated to read so many stories of the resistance of elephants in the past in circuses and in zoos. There really is a fairly lengthy history of keeping animals in these businesses, and it pretty much never ends up well for the elephants, which was very dismaying to see. You had so many interesting but yet depressing stories to share, and I'd like you to tell maybe one or two stories of animal resistance. Jumbo and Tyke are ones that come to mind, and I know elephants are extremely, you know, intelligent as far as we humans judge intelligence, so it just makes the stories even more interesting, if you could speak on that for a bit.
Sure. Well, we can look at Tyke. In 1994, she was working for Hawthorne Corporation, which is they're essentially like a labor camp. So they're a contracting firm that has lots of, they did have lots of elephants and tigers, and they would lease them out for work to circuses, zoos, fairs, whatever, you know, across the country. And then she was in Hawaii that year with mm-hmm. Circus America, and she, while in the middle of the ring, came chasing in while the crowd is watching, chasing a groom, and was beating up on him for a while, and then killed her main trainer, and then took off out of the arena through the crowd, again, not harming anyone, right? The crowd's going crazy, like running all over the place. And yet, again and again, when we see the elephants doing these sorts of things, escaping these arenas, escaping the tents onto the midways, they never hurt anyone except trainers.
Except for their trainers.
Yeah, they're always targeting. So even in like a crowd of people, they'll like spy certain individuals and go after them. So Tyke made it outside. I was going after a clown, which is probably something a lot of people like, since it's often a strongest taste of clowns. And then after someone else that worked for the zoo, and then onto the street she went, and eventually she was shot dead by the police, which has happened quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And you could look at this in a depressing way, but I think you should look at this because if you want to look at it as far as dominance, if you're looking at it in terms of the other side of the coin, in terms of resistance, the thing that we don't often think about, because this event changed history, and it really did. It caused such havoc that Hawthorne eventually could no longer lost all its elephants. They had to give them all up. And the sanctuary in Tennessee was started because of this event. Now, would the sanctuary, Hohenwald been started? If not, I don't think so. At least not at this point in time. You know, sometimes it takes an action of courage and of sacrifice sometimes to make actual social change in the world. And part of this book showing that animals do have the power of agency, and they do have the power to create historical change.
Tyke was a martyr then for the cause, which at least is something good that came out of it. And, you know, I was really interested to read that the elephants really have no mercy when they decide to gore their trainer with their tusks or stomp on them, as many of them did, to kill them. They knew that was going to kill their trainer. And it's interesting because, you know, their values are different than us humans. We don't kill people that easily, but they had no mercy. They knew what they were doing, and that's what they wanted to do. So I just find that very just fascinating. You are listening to the Animal Voices radio show here on 102.7 CFRO, and we are talking here with Jason Hirabal on his new book called Fear of the Animal Planet. So in your opinion, what is the message that these animals are comprehensively sending to humans when they choose to resist and kill?
Well, normally that, you know, they don't want to be in these circumstances. So in the case of pike, you know, there were particular steps that led up to this. 1993, there were two incidents with her that should have been a warning message before the final one in 1994. So the first one, she escaped from her circus. And then they had to, I think they were inside of a building, and she ran up onto the second tier, and it took a long time for her to get her down. And then just a few months after that, she attacked a trainer, but did not kill the trainer. So the elephants do show mercy. There's always like a procession of steps. So they will hurt the trainer a little, you know,
quite
a bit. And then if that message is not heeded, then we'll get a definite killing after that. And they'll make sure that that person is dead. Mm-hmm. And often, and sometimes they'll kind of stop after that. And then there's an additional step where they will just take off running, and they will not stop.
Yeah, that's it. They've had it.
Yeah, and I'm quite confident that because they're so trained in violence, and they have such an education in violence, you know, being beaten with bull hooks and et cetera throughout their lives, that they really understand that this is the final step. And I'm quite confident they know that, you know, there's probably no coming back from this.
Oh, yeah, I know. A large part of the book is also dedicated to stories of monkeys and their relatives. And, you know, both monkeys and elephants are known to be two of the most intelligent animal species, as intelligence is measured in human terms. You tell all kinds of wild stories about monkeys and gorillas and chimps and orangutans escaping from zoos and research laboratories. Could you tell us just one of these stories? I found the stories of Alfie and Little Joe to be particularly interesting, for example.
Sure. Little Joe was an adolescent gorilla at the zoo in Boston. I forget the exact name of it, but it's the main zoo in Boston. And in 2003, he escaped twice from an exhibit which he should have never been able to escape from. You know, the zoo, the engineers, the biologists all assumed that there's no way that a gorilla could get over a 12-foot wide, 12-foot deep moat. He did once.
Mm-hmm.
So then they made some changes to it. They added electrified wires, a couple other things, and then he did it again. And this was just utterly humiliating to the zoo, because not only the second time did he make it into the zoo grounds, like he did the first time, but he actually made it off the grounds, into the city of Boston, including at a bus stop, where people were standing waiting for the bus.
Yeah.
They look over, and there's a gorilla, and then Little Joe took off running again. And it was really... it's really amazingly humiliating to zoos. And so, you know, this happens all the time with gorillas. I mentioned a really famous one called Evelyn, a female gorilla from the L.A. Zoo, who escaped 7 times, okay, from her enclosures. Each time, the zoo would make changes, and each time, Evelyn would outsmart them. And the thing about making history here is that when this news becomes public, then people start becoming interested. This is when animal welfare and animal rights organizations really start gearing up. And so this is when journalists start exploring. So that's what they did. And then we start finding out about the horrible conditions that the gorillas were living in. And they found out that there was 35 escapes in over a 5-year period in the LA Zoo of a variety of animals. So they decided, okay, we'll spend the money and we'll build a new exhibit. So they send all the gorillas to Denver in 2003, and what does Evelyn do? She escapes from their zoo. And again, journalists start exploring it and looking into it, and lo and behold, there have been 45 escapes at the Denver Zoo over a 5-year period. So, you know, these escapes, these acts of resistance can really propel humans to start making decisions and choices, whether it be in the zoos or outside the zoos, forcing the zoos to do different things.
I like the one comment you made about little Joe. You said, is a teenage ape really smarter than a medley of experienced keepers, curators, and engineers? No comment. I think people can decide that for themselves. So I just wanted to talk about why zoos and aquariums and circuses are so resistant themselves in giving up their animals, even when their animals have proven to be human killers. It's all about money, isn't it? And can you talk to us about the kind of money involved in the profit making of these operations?
Yeah, even if they're nonprofit, you know, they're existing purely for themselves, you know, to keep operating, to keep having the jobs. So whoever owns SeaWorld, you know, is making billions a year, you know, in profit. And that's usually, the books are closed, but, you know, that's what they're making. And even then, though, that the acts of these creatures can upset that dynamic. So, like in 1987, when an orky almost killed a trainer at SeaWorld, it was so crazy, sort of like what's going on today at SeaWorld that you were talking about earlier.
Right.
That they fired everybody, all the executives, okay, in order to survive. That they had to shut down everything for like a year before like letting trainers back into the water again. And in the end, the publishing corporation, the giant corporation that owns SeaWorld, the profitable SeaWorld, said, I had enough of this, and they sold it. Okay, all because of one act of resistance by an orca.
So that act of resistance actually, it snowballed into an action to shut it down. Now, you say in your book that the zoo industry is full of contradictions. What do you mean by this? Can you talk about some of these contradictions?
Well, like I said about, you know, they'll say control. They'll say, yeah, they'll admit to this. You know, there's a lot of issues about control and dominance. And yet they won't look at or even see that the other side of the dynamic, which is resistance on the part of the creatures. You know, they'll ignore the agency of these animals. And in a lot of ways, it's because they don't want other people to see it. You know, because, you know, they'll say, animals are really important, but we'll not really learn about what is vitally important to the animals themselves.
You know, I just find it, like, there's just so much resistance from the animals, from the stories that you've told in the book, that it seems like it's not even worth it, because the animals are fighting, and they're fighting hard, you know, but the zoos and circuses, they keep doing this. Do you think that maybe in 50 years from now, we're going to see a diminishment of these industries, maybe due to further resistance from animals, or perhaps animal rights activists?
It's possible, you know, I mean...
Do you see a downward trend, is what I'm asking?
I think it's quite possible. You know, you can never determine what might happen, you know, historically down the future. But I can just say for certain that the resistance, you know, will continue, you know, inside of the zoos, and then the animal rights community is definitely growing, especially among young people, and that this pressure always has an effect, you know. We tend to be pessimistic a lot of times when we think about what the things we can do, but I can assure you that many times, you know, SeaWorld, for instance, you know, was almost knocked down for the count.
About zoos, they say that it helps people learn about the importance about animals, but not what is vitally important to the animals themselves. And I think that's really sad. What message should we humans take away from all of these culminated instances of animal resistance?
That there is, a power relationship that's going on in zoos, and that there's two sides to it that I said in the beginning. And we need to start looking at the other side. So even zoos, even animal welfare people, even animal rights people, they tend to ignore the agency of the animals themselves. And this is really important, because it was this research that changed me from a cynical person, from a person who was completely indifferent about other animals, who was fairly conservative as far as, like, do animals really have intelligence or, you know, ability to resist? I would say probably not. You know, I would probably say probably not before I am. But this research completely changed me. And if it changed me, you know, that's why I wrote the book, because I think it could possibly change others.
That's a great ending there. Thank you so much for coming on the show today, Jason, to talk to us about your new book. It's called Fear of the Animal Planet, The Hidden History of Animal Resistance. Thanks again.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Animal Voices Radio Show on 102.7 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Remember to enter our contest draw for a copy of Jason Hribal's book, Fear of the Animal Planet, The Hidden History of Animal Resistance. To enter the draw, please go to our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and click on the Discussions tab to submit your entry there. Or you can email us your name directly at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. If you're not on Facebook, to be eligible to win, you must have not won anything from us in the last year, and you must be able to pick up your prize at the radio station in downtown Vancouver. Deadline for entries is next Friday, February 25th at 9 a.m., and we'll do the prize draw on the show that day, which is next week. And next week on the show, Carissa is going to be presenting a review of Chris Carr's book, Crazy Sexy Diet, and there's a 21-day vegan cleanse in there that she's actually going to partake in. I've heard that she's having a hard time with the green juice, and I think she'll be talking to us about that as well. There will be more surprises coming up on next week's show. And, we here at Animal Voices are asking you to keep connected and visit our Facebook page. Join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR.
And our Facebook's Animal Voices Vancouver. Mm-hmm. Please join.
And please send us your suggestions and comments about the show. And check out our website, www.animalvoices.org, where our shows can also be downloaded from. We'll leave you with this piece by Dr. Will Tuttle called To Be Free, in honor of all the animals living in captivity who just want that, to be free. Please tune in again next week. Thanks for listening, and remember to be kind to the animals.